1975, the present Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, was quoted as saying that the pursuit of equality is a mirage. He said, what is more desirable and more practicable than the pursuit of equality is the pursuit of equality of opportunity. And opportunity means nothing unless it includes the right to be unequal. So what she's speaking in favour of, and the idea that we're basically looking at tonight, is the argument that what justifies capitalism basically is that it's a natural state of affairs insofar as people are given an equal opportunity to become unequal. Now let's look at the let's start at the end, if you like, and look at the end results of this supposed process in which people proudly proclaim the right to be unequal. In Britain today, the richest 10% of the population owns 60% of the wealth, according to government figures. This means that the remaining 9/10 of the population share between them less than half of the wealth. And yet it's precisely those 9/10 who, not having any substantial property or unearned income, are forced to go out and work for a living, and in fact to create all of the wealth that we're talking about. Now the few people who do own all of the factories, offices, plant and property can therefore accumulate more and more by employing, in many cases, thousands of workers, whilst this bottom 9/10 of society is practically nothing but our ability to work. So the working class, which we must define right from the start, is made up of those people who are working for wages or salaries or signing on the dole and are able to accumulate practically nothing, because the wages and salaries that we're paid are generally consumed in everyday living expenses. Now, as far as share ownership in industry is concerned, 7% of adults in Britain possess all privately held shares, and 80% of the privately held shares are owned by 1% of the population. The Supplementary Benefits Commission has found that nearly 3 in 5 unemployed people have no money whatsoever at all after 1 month out of work, so much of the savings made by the working class. Inland Revenue Statistics, quoted in a television programme on BBC Two on the 5th of March 1982, showed that 75% of the wealth of the richest 1% was inherited when originally acquired. So you see clearly that you're not simply dealing, contrary to what Thatcher said, with a process in which people go out into society and enjoy this process in which people who are somehow intrinsically superior enjoy rising to the top. 75% of this wealth owned by the small minority was inherited. Now, a lot of views of class are distorted despite this basic clear-cut fact, because in 1953 a Gallup poll was taken, it's the only one that I've come across of its kind, asking people what class they were in. And half the British people questioned and nearly 9/10 of the American people questioned claimed to be in the middle class without any definition of what they were in the middle of. So the socialist starting point in dealing with the arguments about equality and inequality has to be class. We take a realistic view of the two classes which exist within society. We have to make clear that class today is still determined by people's relationship to the productive machinery of society. Do you own the factory or do you work in it? Do you organise the production of wealth in one way or another, or do you sit back and receive that wealth in the form of profit dividends? Now, people who are cut off from ownership of the means of production are forced to work for wages and salaries which are in fact worth less than the total wealth which they're producing. The owners who don't depend on wages or salaries for their living depend on getting the surplus which results from this process. And it's worth stressing at the outset that all of the people who have to work for a living are in this class, regardless of the particular type of work they do. In other words, the working class must be seen as a whole, despite the enormous unequal variation within the working class in terms of the jobs that we do and the abilities that we have. The working class as a whole produces all of the housing, from palaces to pigsties. The working class as a whole is responsible for manufacturing all of the food that is consumed, whether it's caviar, whether it's carry-outs. We're doing all of that work as a class. Now, according to the Royal Commission on the Distribution of Wealth and Income, from which report I drew the figure at the start of the talk about the distribution of wealth, also state, and I quote, average earnings in different occupations have come to differ much less. Now, here you see that the working class as a whole is, in a sense, becoming more united in terms of income. The wage differential between higher and lower paid workers is today less than it was 100 years ago, and so you see the working class more clearly than ever as a class on the one side with the capitalist class on the other. Now, this basic inequality in capitalist society which I'm going to come on to demonstrate is quite artificial and far from natural, nevertheless does exist at the moment. And the nature of this class division is summed up quite well in a book entitled Class in a Capitalist Society by J. Westergaard and H. Ressler, published by Penguin in 1975. I quote from the book: "The crucial common component in the life circumstances of the mass of wage earners is their dependence on market sale of the labour. How crucial is evident from the wide range of other terms of life in which they share and which clearly separate them by a gap incomparably greater than the internal divisions amongst them from the minority for whom the wheels of private capital turn." In other words, wages and salaries may vary from, say, £50 a week to £400 a week, but every £1 million which is invested can yield an unearned income amounting to thousands each week. So it's almost as if the capitalist class inhabits a separate world from the rest of us. They don't have to spend their time working for money, and therefore they're able to occupy their time in other ways, whether it's skiing, travelling, shooting or hunting. For example, asked in a television interview some time ago if he meets people with much less money than himself, Rupert Dean, the outspoken millionaire, replied, "Not if I can help it." Capitalists aren't employed, and yet they don't need to sign on the dole either. You can't get the sack from the security of owning property. It's the minerals, the companies, the share portfolios, the land, the properties, and the industrial plant of these parasites which provide the real security and enables them to continue dominating society. About 100 years ago, a working class clerk could hope on occasions to become a partner in the small family firm that he might have worked for. But now ownership has become even more concentrated in effective terms and divorced from the function of managerial work. Small firms are being forced out of business or swallowed up by larger ones, and the size of productive units is growing. So production is becoming more and more socialised on a mass scale. You've got, in a sense, millions of people working together through different productive systems in order to generate wealth, and yet at the same time it's being privately appropriated, either through shares or else through the state. Now, the solving of human problems at the moment is being held back by these inequalities, by the fact that on the one hand you have a class which owns, and on the other hand you have a class which produces. This is not natural, as I said, and it's going to be our purpose to demonstrate that that's the case. But the first point in doing so must be to point out an historical comment on what we've said so far. That particular situation is historically transitory. It's not always existed. And that, in a sense, is both the first and the last argument to demonstrate that it clearly isn't natural, because it has not gone on for all time, and therefore it will not go on for all time. Now, over the past few years, there has developed a school of scientists, or perhaps I should say supposed scientists, who, using rather dubious methods at times, have tried to build up a massive scientific orthodoxy for the traditional human nature argument about the impossibility of human beings to attain a situation of genuine equality and cooperation. Now, I'd like to quote a comment on this school of biologists made by one of their leading opponents in the field by the name of Stephen Rose. He says, and I quote, "It is easy to imagine a better world than the present one, One, for example, where across large areas of the globe people do not die routinely of famine and famine-induced disease, where the perinatal mortality of Liverpool or the Rhondda is no higher than in Hampstead or Bournemouth, where unemployment and routine alienated labour is eliminated, and our children educated to develop their human and creative possibilities to the full, where we live without the imminent threat of destruction from nuclear war, begun by accident or design, and where humanity's relationships with nature are harmonious rather than exploitative." He says it's very easy to imagine this other world. "Yet at the same time, our imagination of our striving for the new world runs full tilt into the claims of hard-nosed so-called realism. What is what must be. It is only human nature," he quotes these people. "Offered a vision of utopia, the realist defenders of the status quo substitute sociobiology." And I'd like to spend the major part of what I have to say dealing with the subject known as sociobiology, which is basically a modern form of social Darwinism, which is sought to defend the human nature theory and the idea that inequality is natural. It's a particular version of evolutionary theory that has become popular in certain quarters, and it's even become a new biological orthodoxy. And this kind of theory about the biological evolution of the species inevitably will contain a given view of human society and the limits which are supposedly imposed on that society by the biology these people are claiming to know about. Now, to explain the theory to start with, they talk in terms of phenotypes and genotypes. The phenotype is supposed to be the type of organism which covers all aspects, both physical and behavioural, whether it's eye colour or mating behaviour. So straight away, the first concept in these people's book is that you don't just deal with some kind of distinction between the physical makeup and the variety of behaviours that you can go in for. The two are one. You have the physical and the behavioural characteristics of a being. On the other hand, you have a genotype, which is a makeup of genetic material, the compound DNA, which forms the substance of all life. Now, many biologists are claiming that the phenotype for human beings is determined by the genotype, directly and exclusively, and that successful organisms are those best adapted to their environment. Now, in terms of your material environment, socialists would have very little to argue with in the basic idea of Darwinism, that there is a need for an organism to adapt to its environment, and the more that is the case, the more generally successful that organism will be. To us as socialists, this is almost common sense. What they're doing here, however, surreptitiously even, is linking to that the idea of behaviour in a social sense. They're actually saying that the genes which form beings such as mankind will determine rigidly the behaviour, the social patterns, the trends, the fashions, the styles of relating to one another which exist in society. Now, if you couple that with the idea that genes can either be successful or unsuccessful, then you've reached a situation where the claim is being made that human behaviour is determined by certain genes in our bodies which are forcing us to behave in certain ways so that those very genes will reproduce themselves and propagate themselves rather than us. And this is in fact the theory put forward by a number of reputable biologists at the current moment in relation to human nature. It has quite a long history behind it. For example, the geneticist Weismann at the turn of the century used the term germplasm to describe this idea of the basic physical substance inside us. And he said that the germplasm is immortal. It lives forever. In other words, it gets passed on from one being to another, and it's determined to make sure that it retains the same characteristics in terms of behaviour. So, sociobiology begins by asking, on apparently Darwinian principles, whether it's possible to explain altruistic or self-sacrificing behaviour in this sort of way. Why is it that people very often seem to be behaving in ways that aren't ruthlessly satisfying their own interests? Now, faced with that puzzle, these human nature people have found a somewhat crude way out of it. Rather than taking the socialist answer of saying that people, of course, will look after others if and when they realise that that is in their own interests as well, in other words, you unite the two. In a socialist society, you combine individual and social interests because what's in your interest will be in the interest of others around you. But instead of taking that socialist outlook, what they're trying to do is to say that altruistic behaviour is in fact simply a means whereby the selfish genes inside each of us can propagate themselves. For example, it's been argued by Richard Dawkins, one of the prime exponents of this theory, that when a mother looks after her child, the only reason she's really doing that is not because of some consciousness of social interest or her interest or the child's interest, but in fact, it's because her genes are forcing her to look after that child, in a physical sense, in order that that child will then flourish and prosper because it has some of her genes, and then those genes will carry on into future generations. If the child dies, the gene in question will die. And he argues for the same reason that we have a diminishing level of concern about cousins, second cousins, third cousins, not because we don't see them all that often, but because they've got, in each case, slightly less genes than the one before, similar to our own, and therefore, in genetic terms, it pays us less dividends to look after them. Now, these theories, which may seem slightly crankish, have been popularised in recent years, and they've been used to explain and to rationalise, and therefore justify, such concepts as racism, sexism, and indeed capitalism itself. In other words, it's been argued that inheritance, genetic inheritance, is the mechanism for creating such things as intelligence, political forms of behaviour, and so on. And yet, on a scientific level, these theories, which try to turn human nature into a fixed and, in fact, pro-capitalist thing, on scientific terms, the theories are full of holes. And I'm going to list three or four major scientific arguments which knocked down the case of the sociobiologists. Firstly, this form of social Darwinism or sociobiology is reductionist. In other words, it tries to explain the properties of complex wholes, organisms or societies, solely in terms of the characteristics of the individual parts of which they are composed. For example, the nature of society can, according to these people, be simply understood by adding up the characteristics of each individual one by one, and then you add up to your society that you're trying to understand. People individually seem aggressive, add that together, and that's why you've got a society which has a ritual of organised war every so often, because individuals one by one have got aggressive genes within them. But it's obviously far more reliable to take a dialectical approach and to recognise the fact that the final product is not simply the aggregate of the constituent parts. When you add up, when you have quantitative accumulation, then it brings a qualitative change as well, a change in the very nature of what you're trying to add up. Society in turn as a whole will affect the individuals which compose it. And therefore, we have to look at history rather than biology to understand the way in which society has changed, because history is to do not with the actions of individuals, but history means the actions of collectivities of people over long periods of time. And in that sense, you see that society changes precisely when the individuals start to act as groups rather than as individuals. Secondly, the argument is fallacious because it's an example of biological determinism of the most crude kind. In other words, the biochemical properties of the cells which make up our bodies are supposed to determine our behaviour according to these theories. Now, it's very true that our physical bodies mediate our behaviour. If somebody becomes aggressive, it will no doubt have something to do with the adrenaline. It will create adrenaline running in their system. And in that sense, if you stop somebody in the middle of a temper, in a tantrum, you'll find that physically they're in a given state. But to therefore say that the physical state came first and therefore they miraculously found themselves in a temper would clearly be absurd. The reason they went into a temper was because of social relationships, interactions with other people on a social and historical basis, and that then produces physical or biochemical changes in their body. Now, even in a liberal newspaper like The Guardian, you get examples of this sort of thing. At the time of the Brixton riots in 1981, The Guardian located the cause in, quotes, a poverty of aspiration and expectation created by family, school, environment, and genetic inheritance. And yet there was no proof offered, needless to say, of how it is that one can genetically inherit poor aspirations in social terms. Third, there is the problem of reification. In other words, taking a concept or a process or a relationship between people and looking at it as if it was a thing. Looking at it as if it was a simple object that you could weigh in the palm of your hand or measure with a slide rule, which of course you can't do in quite the way they're trying to. For example, what a lot of these theoreticians have done is that they've taken a quality such as altruism. And they've said, on the one hand you have a mother looking after her child, that's altruism, care for others. On the other hand you have a soldier fighting for his so-called country. That's altruism, because he's not doing it for himself. He's being very selfless and he's going to get killed for his country. And they've tried to say that these two situations are the same, are identical. They're both examples of altruism. But of course, only a very crude use of language would allow you to say that these two situations are equivalent or perfectly parallel. The word altruism is being used very loosely in both cases. But they try to extract the essence, to isolate the concept, altruism, and then go around trying to spot it in people, which is very hard to do because you won't actually find a part of your brain or anywhere other part of your anatomy where you can actually find a thing called altruism. It's very much a thing that merely arises in the way that people relate between one another. So having tried to relate a static object within the brain, a piece of altruism or a piece of aggression or a piece of competitiveness, they then try to measure these things, and so you have the notorious intelligence tests, which in general have taken virtually no cognizance at all of the idea of cultural variation, of what intelligence might mean in one place wouldn't make very much sense necessarily in another place or another time. Imagine, for example, if you expressed gratitude for a favour which someone has done you. And having done so, they responded to your expression of gratitude by taking out a pocket calculator and saying, excuse me, do you mind if I just quantify that gratitude for a moment? Because your gratitude gene is obviously a determined little bugger which is asserting itself in this prominent way because it wants to propagate itself and produce other genes of gratitude. This may sound facetious, but this is in all seriousness the kind of theory we're really talking about when we deal with human nature theories about inequality. Now, armed with these dubious and pseudo-scientific tools, these sophisticated and respectable leaders of the human nature brigade go out into the world ready to explain all manner of objectionable trends in behaviour as being merely healthy reflections of the struggle. Not the struggle between classes, between boss and worker, which is in fact the real struggle, the social and historical reality which we as socialists are interested in, but instead the struggle between various types of DNA, the chemical of which all human beings are generally, of all human beings are composed. So, for example, if a man is seen pushing a woman about because of the way in which both he and she have been conditioned into that situation, then this is because the genes he has picked up, so they say, in his hunting past thousands of years ago, are still determined to root out and dominate the genes which she has developed also long ago for the skills of rearing children. The genes, in other words, are supposed to be endowed with a consciousness of their own. And this idea is sort of comes across very clearly in the title of one of the key works in this field, The Selfish Gene, by Richard Dawkins, which gives the gene a consciousness which allows it to be selfish. Now, in that work and in other works of sociobiology, there is very much an imagery of the marketplace. And you often get this when you hear scientific exposés on television and elsewhere. You'll see a picture on the screen about the inside of some chromosome or what have you. And you hear the man who's commentating say about the war that's going on, or they've captured such and such. And they use military metaphors and so on. And it's no coincidence, because basically all of this so-called scientific theory about inequality is simply, and all said and done, a reflection of capitalism. The theory itself is a reflection of the marketplace mentality, nothing more or less. And that's the basis on which we have to attack it. Now, of course, some of these theories run into fairly big problems. For example, in the case of the man who I said was pushing a woman about, what would happen if her supposedly weaker genes were in fact defeated, as logically they probably would be before very long? If her genes were defeated in the long run, then, of course, femininity, the female half of the species, would be vanquished, and therefore the existence of males would become redundant too. There would only be one sex left. So clearly it's not a process, it's not a conflict in the genuine sense, which can lead to victory. And secondly, the people who were advancing these theories ran into quite a complicated argument on the subject of homosexuality, because of course homosexuality is hardly a form of behaviour which is designed to perpetuate the genes of the people involved in the way that they claim other forms of behaviour are. But even there, the theorists of human inequality had an answer. The sociobiologists have claimed that homosexuals are in fact undercover helpers in the rearing of their relatives' children, and therefore they're sneakily helping a proportion of their own genes along into the next generation. Now, a lot of this can be compared with such other pseudosciences as we had in the 19th century, such as phrenology, which in its day was seen as a highly respectable science based on the idea that if you feel somebody's head, you can tell where they've got certain bumps, and having done so, you can then assess their character, their past and their future and so on. There are even people around today who still believe in this, but not many. But at one stage, that was a serious theory, and in fact, there's a very close parallel. The only difference is now they've given up feeling for the bumps, and they've had to start cutting up and looking inside instead. They still haven't actually found them. So, to sum up this stage of the argument, the idea is that genes for altruism or aggression confer upon their possessor the property of acting altruistically or aggressively. And the main problem with all of this argument is that it's trying to base social characteristics within the body. It's saying that within somebody's body, you've got a bit of aggression or a bit of altruism. And in fact, these concepts are absolutely meaningless until you get outside the body and start to look at society, where things like aggression and altruism start to have a serious meaning. Now, fourth and finally, on this argument, the final trick that such people perform is to look at the non-human animal world and to spot behaviour which they claim is reminiscent of human behaviour, and they then come back and insist, therefore, on the biological nature of the phenomenon. In other words, sociobiology has spoken of slave-making or propaganda techniques in ants. They've spoken about gang rapes in mallard ducks, or of harems or councils of elders amongst the baboons. So the PG Tips adverts have got a great deal to answer for in that case. But in fact, the mirror which they're turning on nature has been fashioned by human expectations, and therefore it's hardly surprising that we seem to see human faces reflected in it. This mistake of anthropomorphism, as it's called, has been scientifically recognised in the past as a fallacy. You can't look into the natural animal kingdom and think that every other animal is in fact doing something which you see as distinctly human. You're simply reading into it in the same way that Beatrix Potter, when she wrote of Peter Rabbit, made him speak with the voice of a naughty little boy instead of anything vaguely resembling the characteristics of a rabbit, and that's all that's happening, basically. So you might say that you've seen animals being very aggressive, other than man, when threatened or challenged. And you look at them and you think, yes, that's just like I've seen humans doing, and therefore it's simple. Clearly animals don't have social conditioning through the media, and therefore this must be part of life on Earth. But there are two mistakes with saying that. Firstly, terms such as aggressive have to be used with great caution when they're being applied outside of the human situations which they were originally invented for. To use words like aggression about dogs, for example, fails to take account of the subtle but important changes of meaning which apply when you attempt to use the word elsewhere from where it originated. In other words, what we mean by aggression is slightly different from what it could possibly mean in relation to animals who don't have speech, who don't have arguments in that sense. Secondly, you could say that it's true that a lot of animals might go out to kill rather than be killed, but then so would I, and so would you probably in the ultimate when it came to the crunch. This is not aggression without reason. It's a simple case of self-defence. But notice, it doesn't happen within the one species, generally, of animals. There may be exceptions, but in the vast generality of cases, you see animals being very often murderous toward between species in a basic open conflict and battle. It's quite honest, and it's not at all... I shouldn't apply the word honest to animals at all either, but I mean, it's quite open. You see what they're doing. Where you have theories of racism, which try to draw on all of this, of course they're making the mistake of watching animals fight between species and saying, oh, well, this justifies the whole thing. You see human beings with the same kind of violence, but that's within one species, so it has to be explained in social rather than biological terms between species. And also bear in mind that when animals fight, it's not organised or ritualised, as in the case of human warfare, which is clearly so highly socialised and planned for specific economic reasons that people have to be put into uniform. It's not at all a natural affair. In fact, Jean Rostand, the French biologist, has pointed out that so-called aggression no more explains war than the fact that bats have wings would lead us to expect human beings to be able to fly. Now, the political implications of all of this are, of course, profoundly conservative. And they've been voiced by a very wide variety of people. You've had Patrick Jenkins, for example, using this kind of theoretical analysis to say that a woman's place has to be in the home. You've had defenders of capitalism in general saying that biology justifies the market system. The National Front has said that racism and racial conflict is genetically enforced. And you've even had somebody, it may seem surprising, Germain Greer, who has indirectly endorsed a lot of this theory, in stating the assumed inevitability of rape as a problem in human society. Now, let me say at this stage, we've got to avoid the opposite mistake as well. It would also be incorrect, and indeed utopian, to say that society could be totally free of biology. What we need, in fact, is a synthesis to understand that biological evolution does place limits on us. Biological evolution, however, has produced a very unique situation in the world at the current stage where there is so vast social flexibility despite certain biological limitations. So we don't want to divide rigidly our ideas on the subject in between, on the one hand, culture or society, and on the other hand, physical biology. We have to realise that the mind and the body, this is a false dualism or duality. In fact, these things are all part of the same process. The organism and its environment have an active interrelationship between the two. Now, what is human nature? Well, there are certain universals that we walk on two legs. Our height is generally between 1 and 2 metres. We can see light waves only of a certain range of wavelengths. And we can't grow wings, we can't fly. Or can we? We can't grow wings and fly in the way that birds can. And yet, within the past 100 years or so, the fantastic potential for adaptability and intelligence, if I may use the word loosely, in human consciousness, has enabled us to overcome even this apparently obvious limitation. With the aircraft, we not only use the unique human asset of conscious social cooperation in order to imitate other animals with their power of flight, and other animals which have the natural physical capacity to fly, but we can also go one stage further than the birds by having hundreds of people travelling together in the one vehicle as a piece of coordinated transport planned precisely to deposit them from A to B. So, human nature basically comes down to a question of self-consciousness, the ability to make our own history. And this includes the political arguments that go on between socialists on the one hand and biological determinists on the other hand. That is part of the making of history, and it's because of that that we're very anxious to see the argument take place in an informed spirit. Now, Karl Marx made this point some time ago in the 1840s in relation to the adaptability of human nature as opposed to animals. In a very interesting way, if I may quote. He says, "The animal is immediately one with its vital activity. It is not distinct from it. Man makes his vital activity into an object of his will and consciousness. He is not immediately identical with any one of his characterizations." It was an excellent statement there from Marx, explaining how it is that human beings don't, when we walk or when we swim, we're not doing these things because it's the only thing we can do. We've not been programmed in the way that a bee has to make hexagons in honey. We're doing it in a thoughtful and planned way, and we can actually pick and choose. We can actually choose not to walk if we don't feel like it, or not to swim, or to do those things. There's a fantastic adaptability there. Now, I've said a bit about some of these biologists who are trying to defend the human nature theories. Let me stress straight away, there are many who don't. There are a number of reputable biologists in the past year or two who have formed a specific conference, a specific group entitled the Dialectics of Biology Project, who have advanced a hell of a lot of material to knock all of these theories down, a lot of which I've drawn on for tonight. I'll just mention a few of their names for reference. I've mentioned Stephen Rose, there's Leo Kamin, Richard Levantin, hard to pronounce some of these, Richard Levantin, Patrick Bateson, Linda Burke, Jonathan Cook, Brian Goodwin, and all of these biologists, all reputable, whatever that might mean, respected biologists, have come out in opposition to these theories that I've been criticising. I mentioned Richard Dawkins. He wrote a book that I referred to, The Selfish Gene, in 1976. He wrote another book 5 years later in response to a massive criticism that had been flying his way. His new book was called The Extended Phenotype, The Gene as the Unit of Selection. Now, this considerably revised the first book, but it still comes back to a somewhat absurd style of argument. If I can quote once again, he says, "If society systematically trains children without penises to knit and play with dolls, and trains children with penises to play with guns and toy soldiers, then any resulting differences in male and female preferences are, strictly speaking, genetically determined." Well, of course, I don't know how apparent it is. I think it's fairly apparent that this is clearly fallacious on his part. He's actually said himself that society is training people in this way. Society has taken a biological marker, which is there in the first place, but has then chosen to use that biological marker as a social determinant in the way in which children are brought up. A bit like if you were to actually, just to take another example, a physical basis of height, you could say that all people who are under 1.5 metres will be trained for one set of preferences, and if you're over 1.5 metres, you'll be trained for another set of preferences. It would be no less absurd than what's going on in the ways in which people are being trained for their sex roles, but even more specifically for their class roles, in which, because you happen arbitrarily to have been born into the working class, you're being trained to have the expectations, the low expectations, which the Guardian earlier, when I quoted them, were referring to as being genetically inherited. In fact, these are being pushed into people. Now, I'd like to come on quite briefly and deal with the three main areas in which these kinds of theories of biological inequality are applied in a practical way. There's racism, sexism, and most importantly of all, the idea of the class division itself. And I'll look at what each of these arguments is about briefly. Firstly, on the question of racism, there is in fact no scientific basis to racist theories. The species has basically uniform mental potentialities and physical attributes, basically uniform. There is one genetic stock, in other words, Homo sapiens. Now, if there were any isolated evolutionary mutations which distinguish particular groups in isolated parts of the world, this has now become increasingly irrelevant because of the obvious factor over the past 1,000 years or so of rapidly developing communications. It's meant that the species is very much united in its basic potentialities in its work from day to day. A constantly increasing intermingling of people from across the world in every sense of the term. A worldwide communication and cooperation has allowed mankind to become potentially the worldwide masters of our environment as a species. Moreover, there's no such thing as the British race, often referred to. National boundaries arise arbitrarily out of the conflicts over property and profit. And skin colour is no more important than eye colour to somebody's socially produced character. In any case, skin colour is arbitrary in the way in which it's defined. For example, in America, Indians are classified as whites. I don't mean American red Indians, Asian Indians in American terms, for the purposes of racist differentials in census reports, are described as whites, and they're not here. And these things are clearly fairly arbitrary. If you ask racial theorists how many races are there in the world, you have a multiplicity of answers. None of them has a clear theory of this, because there isn't a scientific basis. Some will say there are three, but it's also been argued that there's over 100 different races in the world at one time or another. So there's no clear theory on that. Now, I would therefore argue that the main basis of racism is twofold, in practical terms, what racism is all about. It's not about science or any kind of reasonable argument. It's about two things. One is the irrationality of frustrated workers who are trying to look for a scapegoat other than capitalism, who have been trained to look for scapegoats other than capitalism to explain their problems. And the other point I would make about racism is a simple one, that it's basically a question of divide and rule. It's in the interest of capitalism as a system for workers to be divided. Now listen to this statement from John Tyndall in 1973 as leader of the one of the leaders of the National Front. He says, "What is it that touches off a chord in the instincts of the people to whom we seek to appeal? It can often be the most simple and primitive thing. Rather than a speech or printed article, it may just be a flag. It may be a marching column. It may be the sound of a drum. It may be a banner, or it may just be the impression of a crowd. None of these things contain in themselves one single argument, one single piece of logic. They are recognised as being among the things that appeal to the hidden forces of the human souls." So in other words, you have an interesting statement there from the NF themselves about the way in which they're seeking to appeal to irrationality, in a word. And in that sense, the way to defeat those arguments, as with all examples of irrationality, is with its opposite, its logical opposite, rationality, to drive out the irrationality with the arguments of rationality. Now take an example of this in action. Bulldog, the newspaper of the Young National Front. One issue of this, I'm going to show you, it's a genuine copy, bought fresh from Chapel Street, but it must be genuine. And they quote a song called White Power by the National Front pop group Screwdriver, the words of which run as follows. "Stand and watch my country going down the drain. We are all to blame now, we must be insane. We're letting them take over and we just let them come. Once we had an empire, and now we've got a slum." Now, of course, you see it there, the frustration I referred to, which is leading these people to try to find a scapegoat and accuse others of being unequal with themselves. Most of the people who read that haven't read the subtle and nonsensical theoreticians of racism, some of whom I've referred to. People who read that are suffering all of the poverty that we all suffer. Possibly, in many cases, people who are appealed to by that are suffering even worse poverty than a lot of their fellow workers. They say, "We once had an empire, now we've got a slum." But of course they didn't have an empire. When Britain did have an empire, their great-grandparents were still living in slums, even back then. So it's in fact a basic myth which we as socialists have simply got to correct in straightforward, factual terms, the only way to do it. And you can do this by quoting the economic analysis which demonstrates what's really been going on. In 1947, the Government Economic Review had this to say. "Foreign labour can make a useful contribution to our needs. Foreign labour is the only substantial additional source of manpower which is open to us, especially for the undermanned industries." That's why a lot of people were literally shipped across to man the buses and so on, and as soon as the recession starts to come on, you have a backlash, and people are saying, "Well, we called you over to do a few badly paid and unpopular jobs in the 50s, now the recession's on, and we're going to start taking it out on you and trying to kick you out again." This is basically what's going on. It's, in other words, quite straightforwardly created by capitalism. Now, I've been a bit unfair so far because I was dealing with these sophisticated theoreticians like Richard Dawkins earlier on the side of human nature, who incidentally is often quoted by the National Front in support of their position. But to be fair to the National Front, I shall now quote from their theoretical wing as opposed to simply their youth journal. They have a so-called theoretical journal for the National Front, if that's not a contradiction in terms, And by quoting it, I'm demonstrating that I don't think it's necessarily a contradiction in terms. They do have a theory, albeit an incorrect one. It's called New Nation, the paper, by the way. And they say we must increase our numbers in geometrical rather than arithmetical progression. That can be achieved only if we become a cult among white youth, particularly unemployed white youth. And they go on, Marx, because they have a section on Marxism in the National Front Theoretical Journal, and they say Marx does not explain how it is that human beings are going to change their nature the minute the means of production have been nationalised. Genes cannot be changed, so neither can behaviour. In other words, you have put by the National Front the classical anti-socialist argument, the argument of biological determinism that we've looked at earlier. But of course they state no proof whatsoever for their contention that there's a thing called genetic human nature, which is thoroughly programmed to capitalism, physically programmed to capitalism, which in their words must change the moment we nationalise the means of production, which is their distorted definition of what socialism might mean in any case. So in fact what they're doing is ignoring the whole process of social change through history. They're assuming that history hasn't happened. Now, so much for racism. I said I'd have to be brief, so I'll move on now. The second thing I mentioned was sexism. Now, what does sexism mean? If it means anything at all, it means that the two genetically defined sexes are being regarded in one sense or another as being not simply different in that basic physical or genetic sense, but as being behaviourally defined by those genes in terms of social behaviour. Now, research into sex differences between men and women, has sought out the differences between them, and it's stressed the differences between them at the expense of pointing out the similarities, because most researchers have wanted to do that. They've gone into it, they're looking for something to do, and they've tried to stress the differences in the day-to-day behaviour of men and women in the working class, and for that matter, presumably, the capitalist class. But we're particularly interested in the working class, because that's the class which is so far being sadly divided over these issues. Now, much of the research which has gone into showing that men and women couldn't possibly unite in a harmonious way for working class action because they've got completely opposed forms of behaviour and interests, a lot of the research has been based once again on animals, as if you can study mice or rats and then simply transfer to humans without the slightest need to justify what you're doing, despite the fact that you've crossed the barrier from not just one species to another, but from a set of species which we know very well in other ways are quite different from mankind. They don't speak, they don't write, and therefore why should you analyse one and then simply jump to the other? Now, the deep-grained assumption that runs through pretty well all of us when you think about what you think about for men and women is that men are very often characterised as being naturally active, aggressive, dominant and competitive, and that women are very often characterised as being passive, gentle and submissive, as generalisations. Now the problem here, once again, is that all of these concepts, and I'm sure we all, to some extent, think this, it's so much ingrained into us that you do tend to think of men and women at some point or another in those sort of terms. But the problem you've got to bear in mind, you're dealing with superficialities, you're dealing with momentary behaviour. As far as men and women are concerned, in their biological makeup, the myth of any kind of significant inequality between them as sexes is wrong, because these are all transitory concepts, something like competitive. What about in the stage of primitive communism a few thousand years ago, where competition was virtually unknown on Earth in human society? Were women in those days devoid of competitiveness, and did men have competitiveness? The word didn't exist in the vocabulary of primitive communism, and therefore we see that we're dealing with transitory concepts which are part and parcel of capitalism, not part and parcel of men and women. And you've had books, part of the sociobiology set once again. For example, Stephen Goldberg has recently written a book entitled The Inevitability of Patriarchy on these principles. You have Desmond Morris in his book The Naked Ape, again going in for the same fallacious arguments about inequality. He speaks about, he's speaking about women. He says that when women lose their virginity, they have sex for the first time, they sometimes feel some discomfort or pain. And he explains this again in very crude genetic terms. He says, the hymen demands that she shall have already developed a deep emotional involvement before taking the final step. So in other words, a piece of a woman's anatomy is demanding, has a consciousness once again, it's demanding that she should be very sure what she's doing, and therefore it punishes her by feeling perhaps some pain to remind her of how careful she has to be. Anthony Storr, the well-known psychotherapist, again, very highly respected, he says, and I quote, The idea of being seized and borne off by a ruthless male who will wreak his sexual will upon his victim has universal appeal to the female sex. Well, I mean, universal means every single woman on earth. It's clearly utter rubbish. Now, you only have to look at, for example, just one example from many. Margaret Mead's excellent book, which I would recommend, Male and Female, it's available in Penguin. And one of the many groups that she studies as an anthropologist in that book is the Arapesh of New Guinea, in which she demonstrates in great detail how there's no aggression there in either sex. Now, I come third and finally to the third practical application of these theories about human inequality and human nature in general, the general political argument in relation to class and capitalism, which draws on all of the others that we've gone through. Now, the cornerstone of capitalist ideology is equality. It's ironic, but the idea of equality, particularly equality before the law, is very much at the heart of the ideology of capitalism. I don't say therefore it exists, but I mean as a catchphrase. Right back in 1789, the French Revolution, perhaps in historical terms, the key moment in the birth of modern capitalism, many would say. The slogan, Liberty, Equality, Fraternity, 1789, France, equality. Now, that's nearly 200 years ago. The capitalist revolution used the concept of equality in order to overthrow the aristocracy whom it was the capitalists were going to replace. Because the aristocracy's privileges rested not on money, but upon land and upon inbuilt title, entitlement to certain lands, therefore equality acted in the favour of the up-and-coming people with money, because they wanted the equality of rights to use that money rather than being barred by the extreme limitations of feudal law, which made people quite unequal. Even if they did have money to spend, they weren't in a free position to spend it in the way they wanted to. But of course, right from the start, this idea, this talk about equality, was riddled with hypocrisy. It's been summed up very well by Anatole France, in a statement, "The law, in its infinite majesty, prohibits rich and poor alike from stealing bread and sleeping under bridges." And you could turn the joke the other way around and say that the law also allows anyone the right to go and stay in the Savoy Hotel for £100 per night. It allows both of these things, and it prohibits begging or stealing for both classes. But clearly, legal equality, which I've just referred to, in fact reflects in society the rise of money. With the rise of money, they could afford to make everything else equal because money would see it its own way. In other words, the dominance and the power of money within society as a concept goes hand in hand with the idea of legal equality in terms of our status. The end of aristocracy in theory and the beginning of a truly market-based fluid society. Fluid in terms of money for the minority who have money, but not for the rest of us who don't. Now, in a leaflet produced in 1795 by the London Corresponding Society, a radical group of artisans, perhaps one might say the future capitalist class in many ways, nevertheless they were, have been argued by some to have been, in a sense, the first signs of a working class movement, in that they were artisans and they were engaged in underground seditious activity insofar as they were writing to one another and trying to oppose the nature of the regime which existed. They produced a leaflet in which they denied the accusation which the aristocrats had thrown at them that they were after real equality. These were the capitalists of times after that. They said, "In our ideas of equality, we have never included, nor till the associations of alarmists broached the frantic notion, could we ever have conceived that so wild and detestable a sentiment could have entered the brain of man as the equalisation of property, or the invasion of personal rights of possession." So in other words, they were horrified beyond words at the idea of equality of ownership throughout society, common ownership. They were simply talking about equality before the law, and they got it over the 100 or 200 years after that, in many senses. A group of Sheffield very early capitalists, radicals, at the time also insisted, I quote, "We are not speaking of that visionary equality of property, the practical assertion of which would desolate the world and re-plunge it into the darkest and wildest barbarism." In France in 1789, in Britain in 1832, workers were led into the belief that if they fought on behalf of their bosses' political equality, it would further their own interests, and of course it didn't. What in fact happened, in the words of Engels in Socialism, Utopian and Scientific, is that these workers found they were in fact supporting the idealised kingdom of the bourgeoisie, and that this equality reduced itself to bourgeois equality before the law, not any concept of economic or social equality throughout the world. Now, in February 1848, in Paris, workers were manning the barricades in order to ensure this right of equality for their bosses. And only 4 months later, those very same capitalists were sending the armed guards in to massacre these same workers for having asked too much in return. Similarly, in England in 1831, in Bristol and in London, there were riots on a loosely similar basis, so that the bosses involved could sit in Parliament after the 1832 Reform Act. And subsequently, in the 1830s, there was a series of notorious legislation aimed against the working class, such as the Poor Law Amendment Act, which brought in the infamous workhouses and so on. So, as far as the capitalist class, which dominates society through its money and its access and power over the wealth, means of wealth production, so far as they're concerned, they're only interested in equality, so far as it will further their profits. Now, an example of this comes from no more tepid a source than the Harvard Business Review. Well, I've got a paper from them here. Don't ask me how I got it, because I couldn't tell you. It's called One More Time. How do you motivate... It actually sounded a bit like a song, but that is what it says. One More Time. How do you motivate employees? It was produced in February 1968, the time of the trouble in France. And the paper, which is written for bosses to work out ways of, in anything but a spirit of equality, of how to squeeze more out of the class which is subservient in society, the paper ends up that the argument for job enrichment can be summed up quite simply. If you have someone on a job, use him. If you can't use him on the job, get rid of him, either via automation or by selecting someone with lesser ability. If you can't use him and you can't get rid of him, you will have a motivation problem. Well, this is the way in which our bosses speak about us, and I hardly need comment on that. So the argument basically runs that the differences, these vast differences in wealth between the two classes, are natural, they're beneficial, we're told. They create more jobs and industry, it creates dynamism and enterprise. Well, is inequality a part of human nature? I think we've seen a few signs this evening so far that it's not. If you do say that inequality is inherent within the nature of humanity, you then have a very thorny problem on your hands. How are you going to start defining which group, which sector of the human race falls on one side of the equality barrier and which on the other? In other words, which is your inferior group and which the superior, if you believe that, that there is inherent inequality? Is it men and women? Is it the two classes? Or is it races? Because those are the three examples that are most commonly involved in the process of trying to argue human inequality. In fact, all human beings have different skills and potentials to offer, and a socialist society based on a common ownership of productive resources, we can see the potential of these people as something which will be valued for, in human terms, not quantifiable terms, in any kind of economistic way. Now, why is it that at the moment we're very tempted at times to look at one another and size one another up in such a way that inequality becomes a dangerous reality? Why is it that today we look at each other and we're tempted to say, well, such and such a person can do A, B, C, so and so can't, he can only do D, and the other person can only do E, whatever these abilities might be? And therefore you're left saying, well, therefore we can see that such and such is unequal to somebody else. Basically, what the reason we do that is because capitalism is conditioning us the whole time to place an economic value, not just on commodities of an inanimate nature, but also on human beings. Because let's not forget, the one hallmark of capitalist world society is that it turns human beings, through their labour power, into commodities. By putting our labour on the market, as we have to within a capitalist economy, we therefore become commodities. And every single aspect of our lives, from the most macroeconomic down to the most intimate and personal, has to be affected by that in material terms. Nothing can escape, and therefore we become entirely commoditized in our mentality, and at times we're tempted to look at one another and place a crude economic type value on one another's abilities, interests, even affections. And that's why people are doing this. In other words, the market has set up an apparently rigid situation where you have to choose between, on the one hand, equality, the idea of human equality, and on the other hand, the freedom for the supposedly superior to go out and dominate others. Now, this choice which we're offered between equality and freedom within capitalist politics is a false choice. It's a false choice because what they're doing is that they're defining freedom only by referring to marketplace-type freedom. They don't think about freedom in terms of freedom for human beings to flourish as individuals in a free society. They're talking about freedom of enterprise. And in that sense, of course, freedom stands in tension against equality. Now, R.H. Tawney wrote a book in 1931 entitled Equality, published by George Allen and Unwin at the time and reprinted in 1979, in which he says, that which thoughtful rich people call the problem of poverty, thoughtful poor people call with equal justice the problem of riches. Freedom for the pike is death for the minnow. And it's pretty well put, particularly that last phrase. Because basically, in other words, freedom is all very well, but when you're talking about the freedom for a socially dominant class to exploit the rest of us, then it's not really the kind of freedom we're interested in at all. That's what freedom means, we're opposed to it. But as I say, don't fall into the trap of saying, therefore, you're opposed to freedom. There are other kinds of freedom worth looking at. Now, I'll say in conclusion then, the apologists for the inequalities of capitalist society, when they've run out of all of the other more complicated arguments, fall back time and time again on the argument that human beings are naturally awkward, aggressive, uncooperative, and basically unequal in terms of their ability and their enterprise. This is the ultimate justification of capitalism. We've looked at sex, we've looked at race, but what about class? What they're saying ultimately, and this in a sense is more significant because it subsumes the arguments about race and class. What they're saying is that workers, whether they're black, white, women or men, they're saying that workers are poorer than capitalists because they deserve to be poorer, because they are poorer in spirit and ability and capability. And we must never forget that that is ultimately what capitalists are saying to us, because anybody who tries seriously to defend capitalism, sooner or later, has to say that. How else are they going to explain the fact that 10% in Britain, for example, own more than half the wealth, and 90% of us, between us, own less than half the wealth in society? They can only explain that with their own justifications by saying, well, the people who've made it have made it because in some sense they're superior. In other words, if somebody's born and inherits millions of pounds, but in some way is severely handicapped in their ability to carry out basic human tasks or in their ability to contribute towards society, are we being told that such a person is innately superior in their enterprise and ability? Of course not. Inheritance is the bugbear of this argument because it makes a mockery of it, and it's been demonstrated. I forget whether I quoted this figure earlier or not. I've got a feeling I forgot to quote it. In fact, I'm sure I did. But it's actually demonstrated from... Oh, no, I did quote it, I think. Demonstrated from Inland Revenue Statistics in a television programme screened in 72 that 75% of the wealth currently held by the richest 1% was originally derived from inherited wealth. That's a pretty significant point worth bearing in mind. So, sooner or later, the working class is waking up to the realisation of the massive insult that's being played on us. We are waking up as socialists to that fact. We're realising gradually the fact that we've been told for a long, long time that we're inferior. 95% of mankind is inferior. The people who create all of the wealth, who run society from top to bottom, are the ones, according to this theory of human inequality, who are useless. Now, clearly I don't need to knock that down, because I trust that people present and others who may be interested are not prepared to stick their neck out necessarily and say, yes, we're all very, very inferior. Of course we're not. That's quite evident from the work we do every day of our lives. Now, faced with that, there is one final last-ditch argument, even more desperate than the human nature argument itself, which such people fall back on, and that is basically one of distortion. The old argument, and I'm going to deal with this one finally, which states that, well, of course, we can't all be the same. I mean, we've all, as socialists, no doubt, have people come along to us and say, You know, that we want to, if somebody's a bit tall, then you have to cut them off just below the knee, this sort of thing. And, you know, what you want everybody to be exactly the same. Well, of course, as I say, deal with this point, it's simply a distortion. Socialists do not either want or expect there to be, in any sense, that kind of equality. People are emphatically not the same. And not only are they extremely different in many ways physically, but also mentally. People have a vast array of different interests, tastes, abilities, characters, and so on. And socialists are the last people to deny that variety. We, in fact, want that variety to flourish. And we believe that it's only when the commoditized existence, the alienated existence of a marketplace society is gone, it's only then that we can start to act as genuine individuals, free from all of the weighty pressures towards uniformity which are being placed on us at the moment. Because if there's one sense in which capitalism has made the working class equal with one another, at least, it's that we are all equal in our status as being commodities fluctuating about on the labour market. That's the situation we want to put a stop to. We want to create genuine social equality, but and in doing so we can allow the flourishing of genuine human inequality in terms of the differences between people.